Hello and welcome to Way Too Twog's Bagpipe and History Podcast, where I, your host, Jeremy Kingsbury, explores the likely repertoire of 18th and early 19th century bagpipers. Let's enjoy some music. So this episode is a little bit different. So generally we wouldn't have an episode out right now, so it's an extra episode. And since last week's episode was a bit of like a half eulogy, half rerun, it felt appropriate to have another one in the feed right away to, make up for lack of new content. Ironically, it's another quasi rerun. If you're not familiar, if you're like new to the podcast or new to piping or haven't started digging deep in the various things, you might not know the name Barry Shears, but you really should. Barry's an incredible piper, and just every time he puts out a tune collection, it is some of my favorite stuff ever. And he's not putting out a new tune collection. He kind of is. He's sending out another edition of Gathering of the Clans. So I had Barry on to talk about Gathering of the Clans on the, I guess it was 30th anniversary of it coming out. And it was a lovely chat. And it was shortly after his one of his more recent books, Play It Like You Sing It, came out. So I was playing through tunes in there and talking with Barry about Gathering of the Clans. And since then, another of Barry's excellent books have come out, and now this new edition of Gathering the Clans has come out, and it's got 31 new tunes in it, so I don't know, I might need to get another copy, but anyway, I wanted to play a couple of the new tunes, and then just let my interview or my chat with Barry go. So I'm going to do this first one, I guess, is my, I like this tune, but it's not, I asked Barry for some of the new tunes, and he sent me two, and they're two marches, and I do not like marches, but in true Barry Shears tune fashion, these tunes rock and make me like marches again. So anyway, here is the first one, which is The Hen's March Over the Midden, a traditional tune arranged by Barry Shears. Kind of a fun little tune. Generally, you know, when I get a new book of music, I kind of look through, and tunes that I don't immediately gel with, I throw out and skip along. The interesting thing, right, was that I asked Barry for a couple tunes, and he sent me two things that at first glance I didn't gel with. And Hen's March in specific, like, I didn't understand how to do that second part until I realized it was sort of cutesy, and went looking up the Dubliners playing it to figure it out, and like, it's foolish. I should have just realized, like, oh, that's the Hen's Concert. Like, so anyway, here is O'Farrell setting for the Hen's Concert, which is very much the same tune. And then, you know what, I'll go from the Hen's Concert from O'Farrell's setting, and then we'll just go straight back into Barry's setting, except on Illan Pipes, of the Hen's March Over the Midden. Thank you. All right, and here's Barry setting for Hens March Over the Midden, but on Ellen Pipes. Cool tune. Looking, just doing a little bit of poking on TuneArc. Supposedly O'Farrell setting is the oldest known setting, but it also said that it's popular in Northumberland, and especially amongst Northumberland small pipers. So yeah, not gonna go and dig for another one, because like, again, at the beginning, Hens March wasn't really my favorite of these two tunes that Barry sent me. This next one, John McCall's favorite, was seriously one of the favorite tunes I've ever heard or played, and I hadn't heard it before, at least not that I know of. So this tune has kind of jumped to my top 10 list very quickly. So here's John McCall's favorite, by John McCall, arranged by Barry. I really needed that. I've been so fixated on history and music theory stuff lately that I haven't just like sat down and learned a new tune that was really awesome. I don't know. Look, playing through Barry's books just always gives me so much happiness and joy. They're good stuff. And I was trying to, it's really convenient for me that Barry is releasing another edition of this book, because when I was playing through old episodes of things that really helped my understanding of kind of the bagpipe repertoire, like the likely repertoire and playing style of 18th and 19th century pipers, a huge part of that was Barry's work and this conversation with Barry. So I'm really pumped to have an excuse to replay it, because I felt like I couldn't do another rerun episode before starting new episodes. So thank you, Barry, for releasing another edition. I'm a little annoyed because I think I'm going to have to get it. It's 31 new tunes, and if just two of them got me so excited, and listen to this copy for the next one, because yeah, I need to get this book. First published in 1991, the collection has gone through several editions, reaching worldwide sales of well over 3,900 copies. The collection has been out of print for several months, so it was decided to offer a limited anniversary edition of 100 copies. 32 new arrangements and compositions have been added to the original collection of 92 tunes, bringing it to a total of 123 marches, reels, stress bays, hornpipes, jigs, and airs, three of which are suitable for small pipes fitted with a high B key or pinch notes on a Highland chanter. Pinched notes? Yeah, gonna have to get this book. Okay, so check it out. You can follow the links in the show notes to find it. It's available kind of where you can get all of Barry's stuff, which, you know, hound all of your Highland suppliers to get it. But also you can go to CameBrentonPiper.com. Yeah, such good music. Okay, so some quick housekeeping, I guess, about this episode I'm going to play you. This is from kind of the Lost series of episodes. Lost in that my hard drive died, and so I don't have the original like file to go in and tweak stuff. And so I'm going to let it run and play out, but kind of at the end of the interview, I kind of have some closing thoughts about the discussion and then say some stuff that isn't going to apply to this, because it's talking about the end of season 5 or something like that. So just ignore the stuff when I'm starting to talk about the mechanics of the podcast afterwards. But unfortunately, I had a recording of Barry playing some tunes underneath that that kind of goes straight into it. So if I want to have those parts still functioning, you're just going to hear it like that. And this is also an older episode, which is a heads up that I have gotten better at sound engineering since this episode aired. But again, I don't have access to it to go in and tweak it. So apologies if you're listening to this in a car. You might have to crank the volume up a little bit to hear it through your car speakers, which is something that hopefully isn't happening anymore with the kind of current run of episodes. So anyway, cheers. Thank you, Barry, for so much awesome music. And be sure to check out Gathering of the Clans. This is just going to start with Barry playing a couple marches from Gathering of the Clans, and then he and I's conversation is going to pick up. It's really fun to hear, like, re-listening to this episode earlier today. I have learned so much more, and there were so many things that Barry said in this conversation that I just kind of smiled and nodded to or didn't pick up on. And yeah, practicing bagpipes and thinking about them a lot, you start to notice some things. So it's I'm just so glad to get to revisit this conversation where probably a third, if not more, it completely went over my head, but still got so much out of the conversation back during season 5. So anyway, thank you, Barry, and check out Gathering of the Clans at capebrentonpiper.com. Cheers.
Been?
It's been all right. Yeah, I haven't been playing pipes as much as I'd like to, so it's been It was nice to have the excuse of kind of looking through your books, man. There's something else. Those are some great collections of tunes. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of the I tried to do a some Strathspeysian reels from Alex section, and boy, the people in the class, when they heard those old settings of tunes, they had a look on their face like I asked them to split the atom. Because, you know, and it's hard to put it across the way he played, because really nobody plays like he did. He had just such a unique style, and putting all these different grace notes in and using...
Were they consistent every time? That was the question I had. Was he always, like, do you have multiple recordings of him playing the same tunes? Is it really precisely the same?
No. Okay, cool. And that's why when I edit it, I edited some of the tunes in his section in the book, but, and they differ again from some of the settings that I got, that I previously published. Like, I have two tunes from him in the Gathering of the Clans Volume 1, and... I got that from one tape, and it was hard to hear because of the party. People were hooting and hauling, and so it was just really a very party atmosphere, and it was really hard. So a couple of notes I didn't quite get, and so I just kind of used my ear and said, okay, well, I'm going to put that in there. So they were, that's why they're kind of arranged by me. But, if you want people to play these old tunes, you have to put them in modern notation, right? Yeah. Because, people that want to go into the dark side, if they get David Wayne's Hooter from 1876, you'll find a lot of these obscure embellishments that were played really all over the areas I researched. And it was so nice to see them in the book, and you think, well, I wonder how they played that. And then you hear somebody play, and you think, of course, it makes sense. But,
Well, I guess it's sort of funny, I guess just congratulations, right? So we're 30 years on from Gathering of the Clans. That's pretty radical. And I realized, I don't know that I had a real strong opinion of what a Cape Breton style is for piping, other than in my head, it's always just been that simple. Well, it's just really dotted and cutted is sort of what it is you just everything is sort of played dotted and cutted is what my brain said. But listening to some of those marches and looking through the tunes, I mean, it's funny to me, some of the dotting and cutting is challenging, but really it just feels like looking through all the old stuff that I looked through, the 1800 or 1700 stuff, where like it feels comfortable to me rather than challenging. Like there's things in there, like those marches you sent, there's dotting and cutting, but there's also those runs that feel kind of out of place with modern piping, but feel totally at home if I'm looking at Robert Bremner or that kind of thing. So I guess I'm just rambling, but what's your like elevator pitch of what makes Cape Breton piping Cape Breton piping?
Yeah, well, first off, Cape Breton piping is kind of a misnomer because people nowadays think it's sitting in a chair playing round, and that's what a Cape Breton piper is. But really, I mean, that's just superficial. If you go back and look at the research, which is why I did that last book, was to kind of show the different settings. I didn't go deep into the different embellishments because, I didn't want to sell. I wanted to sell some copies rather than six books of people that, would be interested in that. And so it was a regionally based style of playing. And just after my recent book came out there 2 years ago, a friend of mine contacted me. He had picked up some wax cylinders of two pipers recorded in the 1905-1910 period. And both of them were born in the 1850s in Nova Scotia on the mainland, right? They weren't Cape Bretoners. So you have to realize there's a mainland portion which juts out. It's when we leave North America and then go to Cape Breton and then Newfoundland. And so... But these guys had the lovely spread burl that Alec Curry used to play, some older settings of tunes. In the case of J.J. Chisholm, very lightly ornamented. I don't think I've heard a grip played in his entire march. And he plays a lovely three-part setting of Culloden Day, which we now know as the Inverness Gathering. And little tricks where he's not super pointed when he's playing. There's a very lyrical sense to his playing, and I think that's one of the main things, or there's one of two main things. There's almost a lyrical approach to the music, and as far as phrasing, tempo, and expression, it's deeply connected to the step dance tradition, which, according to Alec Curry, ended up coming to the Western Isles via Ireland. And so I'm doing some research on that now, and Catherine Foley... she just came out with a book on Irish step dancing, a couple of years old, and she's tracked some of the earlier steps to Italy in the 16th or 15th century, and some of those books are still extant. And so, it's like anything else, it starts off in the center and then it kind of spreads out, and then people put their own stamp on it, and that's certainly, I think, what happened to piping. Alec learned mostly by ear. He learned to read music when he joined the army, but he didn't really, that really didn't really change his style of playing. It was so nice when I heard tapes of Joe Huey McIntyre and sat with Alec to see them use the dree, the Pibroch embellishment that Joseph MacDonald described being used in light music. And I'm hearing examples of this like all over the island, right? And so that was one of the big eye openers.
That's the embellishment that that's in Neil Dickey's Clumsy Lover, isn't it? Like in the second to last part.
He might have one there. I don't play that tune. The piping world in general went crazy when Jim Barry included it in a hornpipe in one of McFadyen's books called John McKenzie's Fancy, and it starts off. Well, that's a Pibroch embellishment. Wow, and light music. Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! And then I hear Alec playing it. He peppers that in there as well as just plain melody notes, which was another eye opener because we're so used to pipe band and competition to almost putting a grace note on just every note. Yeah. And you get that chirpiness, which when you hear a plain note, it's like a breath of fresh air, especially if it's a beat note, right? But now for Joe Huey McIntyre, I mean, that sort of thing. I mean, every time he plays an E, he puts a Pibroch embellishment on it. And of course, for modern piping notation, we play down to the melody note on E. We play a G grace note or a G and an F grace note to give you a doubling. But for Pibroch, you're actually coming from the bottom hand up. Yeah. And so for nuances in the music, that's quite effective. So instead of playing... Oh, I can't really play that same tune because I'm sure you get the idea. And try... Anyway, it's if my fingers were working better.
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, I'm just so imprecise with how I approach the music that I really have to. I think my default is the up stuff, you know, or maybe not. I don't even know. I don't know what my default is, but I know looking at like William Gunn's book or Logan's book, like those mid 19th century ones. Like, you can see the difference. Like, oh, that's not where I expect the grace note to be. Like, where they're not playing, like, where G, like, low G grace notes or low G strikes are just non-existent. No grips, like you say. Like, it's just missing out on all the stuff now I think of, like, grips and burls being so the norm. And then those mid-19th century ones, and they're just not there. Like, it's the GDE stuff is what you get.
Well, and I think what happened at the late 19th, early 20th century, and, you know, I always use the published music as a guide, like more or less as a roadmap, and you can track changes in performance style with each and every one of those collections. And so when you see Robert McKinnon's book come out around the turn of the century, Henderson's Tudor, somebody must have gotten a copy of Joseph MacDonald's and read, Pibroch embellishments used in light music. That must mean Terry Lewis.
Oh, sure.
And Lem Lewis. So let's start popping those in there because some pipers can. But to be honest, there is almost a hierarchy of ability. And so you've got, you know, a couple of hundred players that are at the top of the tree. Then you've got like your musical middle class of people that, you know, can get most of them. And then you've got this huge subclass of people that enjoy the music, but they're no way going to be playing at the level of you know, the top tier pipers. And by taking out a lot of those heavy grace notes, you're giving them accessibility to the music. I was reading one of your questions. Somebody had asked, you know, where did I get the idea for the tunes in the Gathering of the Clans? I had married into a step dancing family, and both my daughters were step dancing. So I had talked to step dancers, and really nobody remembered step dancing to the pipes. They seem to have had their heyday in the 1930s. And I thought, well, that's a shame. Because I had gone up in university in the 1970s, that whole identity building. You know, as a Cape Bretoner going to university in Halifax, right away I knew I was different. And, you know, that was reflected in my record collection, which had Gaelic singing, coal mining songs, pipe music, and Deep Purple, and it pretty well ran the gamut. But there was also a time when jobs were becoming increasingly scarce in Cape Breton, and the music industry was kind of taking off, and Cape Bretoners were struggling for some sort of an identity. There was a lot of humor, a lot of music that was coming out at the time. In 1971, Ron McGinnis did a CBC documentary. It was about a half hour long, I think, called The Vanishing Cape Breton Fiddler. Yeah. And he had gone around, and really, John Morris Rankin and Kinnon Beaton, who would be, Kinnon's my age, John Morris would have been a few years younger, they were really only the two younger fiddlers in the island. And so Ron's premise was, we're in danger of losing this wonderful tradition. And yeah. So a lot of people got together, and then they organized the Glendale Fiddle Festival in the late 70s, and they had 100 fiddlers. A lot of them were old men, but they had people then all of a sudden stood up and took notice. When I talked about piping for step dancing, I had one step dancer who never step danced to the pipes tell me that I was just trying to ride on the coattails of the Vanishing Cape Breton Fiddler with the Cape Breton Piper thing. Sure. And I suppose, to a certain extent, I followed the same formula that Ron did. I said, there was an older style of piping here, which could have done that thing called the Vanishing Cape Breton Piper a decade earlier, and he would have gotten really the tail end of him. As it was, I'm
so
relying.
It's the Vanished Cape Breton Piper is what the is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Did I use some of that? Yeah, a little bit, I guess, maybe unintentionally, but. I learned in Glace Bay, and at that time, 70s, early 80s, witnessing my daughter's step dance. And so I started playing pipes for my daughters to step dance, which nobody was doing. Nobody was step dancing to pipe music. And they were only like 3 and 5, right? And then we'd get gigs around, and people, we played different concerts and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, I noticed people were starting to get an interest in this in the connection. Because the music has to be played quite differently. A classic point, one of my last years competing, I was warming up in the basement at my mother-in-law's place in Antigonish, and I was playing John Morrison of Acid House the way you'd have to play it at a competition. And my late wife's aunt was upstairs, and she said, "Oh, Barry, I've never heard John Morrison of Acid House played as a Strass Bay before." And I said, "Well, no, it's a reel." And she just looked at me and says, "No, it isn't." Meaning the way I was playing it, it was no longer a reel. And so that stayed with me, and I started to think, and as you hear other pipers, and so people, when you realize you're interested, they send you tapes, and you're listening, and you're analyzing this music, and you're thinking, of course, I had to hear that from a dancer, but she is right, because to her, grace notes didn't make any difference. The tempo and the rhythm that she needed in order to execute the steps. And she was a lovely dancer in her day. And so then I started thinking, okay, well, what's wrong with this picture? And then as you peel back the layers of the onion, you realize that 99% of the pipers today don't really play a reel. They play a Strass Bay in competition, and this is bands and soloists. And then they play an old form of the reel called the Strass Bay reel. Because I'm not a dancer, Jeremy, but I can get through a couple of Strass Bay steps and a few reel steps without too much embarrassment. And when I picture back to the way people play Jim Morrison of Acid House, and many still do, I can actually execute Strass Bay steps to that. And so for a dancer, I'm thinking, oh yeah, they're playing a step dance Strass Bay, even though it's, for them, it's a reel. And that's when it really, the penny really dropped then. And it all started off with John Morrison on the big pipes in a basement in Antigonish, I think, 1984. Wow. Yeah.
Is it, to restate what your, what the aunt was saying, it was too slow or too fast to be a reel? Sorry,
It was too pointed.
And
too slow.
Okay.
Right? And so it would be, competition pipers have to play.
Mm-hmm.
as opposed to... Okay, so you'll hear the difference there. It's a little faster. It's a little... it's not as choppy or pointed.
So I have it wrong. Like, I have it backwards. That in my head, it's this idea that it's got to be ultra cut, but that's the opposite of what's going on, really.
It is the opposite, yeah.
Okay.
And if you look at, again, I go back to the published collections, it's at the turn of the last century when you start to see the dot cut come in. Yeah. And I think whoever came up with the idea that, you know, the Scotch snap was that prevalent in pipe music, I don't think they're on the money. The Scotch snap, to me, I always thought was a violin term. And so you get a dot cut or a cut dot rhythm by reversing the direction of the bow.
Okay.
In some cases. So that gives you a little added oomph, right? We don't have that with piping because we don't have the dynamics. So what you find in the 20th century in the written record of music publications is the predominance of this dot cut rhythm or the Scotch snap, right? And it's particularly harmful to dance style strass bass, because you're changing the emphasis and you're becoming more pointed and you're losing that lyrical sensibility. One good example that I use is Lady Loudon, and I know one of the questions that somebody sent in talked about strass bass. Well, Lady Loudon, and I used to win awards with this, was as to the way fiddlers and Alec Curry played it. Strass Bay, of course, in Cape Breton, and most of the areas in Maritime Canada. I'm expanding my research into PEI now, and I'm finding the same predominance of dance piping in communities. And it's amazing the number of pipers in PEI, but that's a separate topic. But so, you know, what differentiates step dancing from Highland dancing that you see at the games? In the 1880s and 1890s, two brothers by the name of McLennan, one of them was a piper and an architect, they found that dancing in Scotland was a little too rustic. And so they studied ballet technique in London and Paris.
Of course.
And they set about changing the way the steps were performed. And so, yeah, it's beautiful to watch. I'm not denigrating Highland dancing. I think everything has its place. But if you're doing scissor cuts, you know, your elevation has come up quite a bit. And so for a piper or a fiddler playing for them, you know, you want them dancing on the beat. And so your music is going to slow down. And sometimes it's pointed more because, you know, you're trying to, you know, accentuate the beat note. And so that you see that transition creeping in. The problem with that is the music becomes slower and it becomes more pointed. When I was on my pipe majors course in Ottawa in 1980 with Archie Cairns and John Carr, they had this big fight about strass bass. And John Carr, who was a drummer, he said we should write strass bass as 12 eighths. And Archie said, well, no, but they're 4-4. And John said, yeah, but nobody plays them as a 4-4, right? And so anybody that goes through competitive piping or the band, when they come to the strass bay, it's point, point, point. I've heard some people say it's not just a dot on the beat note, it's essentially two dots. Right. So what happens, you're going from 4-4, double dotting the theme note, and you're migrating closer to its compound version, which is the 12-8.
Yeah.
And that's why it's really hard to hear competitive bands, especially in the 70s and 80s, there was, you know, an attempt to vary it up, and they'd go from either from a jig to a strathspey or a strathspey to a jig. And it was very hard to differentiate the two because of the compound rhythm. I think Captain John McClellan, he had mentioned judging a competition somewhere, and he said he disliked the juxtaposition of strathspeys and jigs because they were so similar in structure in rhythm. And that's because we held on to the strathspeys for so long, we've actually migrated it from a simple time to a compound. So for step dancing, of course, in Cape Breton, the old dancers really only lifted their feet an inch or 2 inches off the floor. Some of the steps require a certain amount of intricate footwork, and so some of the old dancers would never let the heel of one foot extend past the toe of the other. And so, in common with some of the Irish dancing that Catherine Foley had discussed in her book, you could perform all your steps in the size of the space of a drumhead or a 2x2 square. Now, of course, there are some traveling steps where you're going side to side, but for the most part, a lot of the steps can be executed in a very small space. So, but of course, if you're not coming off the ground or off the floor, then you require a more fluid rhythm, rounder, some people have called. I mean, you still get the dot and cut, but not to the extent that we pushed it so much in the strathspey. Right.
This is almost certainly a derailing and foolish question to ask, I guess. But one of the people that I knew is into Nova Scotia and piping traditions was asking about, you know, possible influence of Acadians and, you know, Mi'kmaq and people like that. And my brain, when you're describing that step dance, and I feel foolish for, I don't know that I've actually ever knowingly watched a step dancer from Nova Scotia in general, but I think about Red River Jig, you know, the kind of Métis indigenous, and like it's sort of billed always as this indigenous and French tradition, but it's just as Scottish as French, like the dancing and the fiddle playing. And that Red River Jig style is this real, real low to the ground shuffle, you know, and that within a drum head, man, that sounds about right. Like,
yeah,
just wonder about how those things are working together or just coincidence or influencing one another.
Well, you know, according to Catherine Foley and other scholars that have been studying dance, it was pretty well, I've even come across a reference of Irish regiments and Highland Irish regiments in particular coming back from the Napoleonic Wars and bringing some of the steps with them. And so I think it was probably a universal style. I mean, we talked, Catherine Foley, you know, executes this better than I would or I could right now. But, you know, you get this center of culture in the Mediterranean, Italian courts, and then it goes, of course, to the upper crust, and then it diffuses, you know, the trickle-down dance theory. And so, of course, with a lot of Europeans coming over, yeah, sure, there was a mishmash of styles and traditions. We play one reel, and I've seen it. I got it from Alec Curry, but I also got a different setting from Peter Morrison, and both claim that the other guy played it wrong. And they only lived, like, you know, as the crow flies, probably, you know, 20 minutes from each other. But they were both Southwest settlements, but they had different ways of playing this. But I heard it called the Indian reel or the Mi'kmaq reel. Was it associated with the dance? I don't know. Because the Mi'kmaq were largely Catholic, if they lived adjacent to Catholic Scottish communities or Irish communities, there was a greater probability of intermarriage than there would be with the Protestant ends. I haven't really found any reference to any sort of cultural exchange, like did the Mi'kmaq or the French influence Highland piping? I'm not sure. I certainly haven't found any references to that because there were so many Highlanders. I mean, Nova Scotia alone got, you know, over 50,000 mostly Gaelic-speaking people in a, you know, 60-year period. And so they put their stamp on Cape Breton and northeastern Nova Scotia and large swaths of PEI. Right. So if there was influence, it would have been minimal, I would think. Yeah. But that tune... it's in the Alec Curry section, and it's a And again, you know, I learn tunes and then you don't look at the music for a while, so you kind of adapt it. But
cool. Yeah, I think, you know, where there's real clear influence of, like, indigenous music on fiddling and things, it's in the opposite situation, right? Where there's, like, one to ten lone Scottish or Acadian, you know, fur traders in a sea of indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, their kids go on to play. There's an awesome documentary from the 70s of Cree fiddlers from James Bay going to Orkney. Mm-hmm. And, like, and it's sort of a similar thing. This is something you talk about in the book too. So this isn't the dumbest transition, I guess. But it's sort of, it's the same thing where when these Cree fiddlers show up in Orkney, kind of having both evolved their own tradition. But the Orcadian fiddlers were kind of convinced that the Cree fiddlers may have been playing an older style anyway. Like their approach to the music was really different than mm-hmm. the really kind of stuffy fiddle orchestras of the, I guess it's the 70s or the 80s in Orkney, mm-hmm. where it's just everybody playing exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And these Cree fiddlers are, you know, they're playing crooked. They're just kind of adding extra beats whenever they feel like yeah. it, kind of stopping whenever it feels right to them rather than
yeah.
really following everything structured.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so I guess that was the transition into the question about Gathering of the Clans. Like, we get this sense of, you know, in the last, since Gathering the Clans, and you know, pretty recently, there's been a lot of attention from Scotland and Scottish piping of kind of valuing what's going on in Nova Scotia. But it was interesting to me, in the introduction, you talk about that happening already in the 20th century, like early 20th century, of, you know, people in the Highlands, you know, Highland pipers from Scotland coming over to, like, look at the state of piping in Nova Scotia. I guess, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I wish I had more information on that. It's, you know, and you know, when I wrote that book in, you know, 1991, again, you know, other information pops up to light. What I found was that I think one of the judges in Charlottetown, where Professor Archie Beaton beat all comers, he was recently brought over by the North British Society in Halifax. They advertised, they wanted to have a permanent piper in Halifax. And so they advertised for David Manson to come over. He was considered in the top five pipers at the time. He only stayed in Halifax a couple of years, and then he got a better offer from Montreal. So he went to Montreal. Money talks. But yeah, so, you know, as a Scottish piper, he would have, of course, been called on to adjudicate competitions around the Maritimes. Unfortunately, I've gone through some of the newspaper reports of that competition in Charlottetown, and it very rarely mentions the judges. I did find one of the earliest pibroch competitions in Charlottetown in 1863, and it was advertised in the local paper, and pipers had to submit two pibroch and two marches and two reels as part of their competition regimen. And the piping went on all day, so there must have been a lot of them that played.
Yeah.
It listed the three first prize winners. The competition was organized by Neil Rankin, who was the son of Con Dooley Rankin. He was the last piper from the college in Mull, or Call. And Robertson was the judge, and Robertson brought his pipes and played the Kogit Nashi, or War or Peace. And he put his pipes down, then he sat at the table and proceeded to adjudicate pibroch. So there's a lot of pipers now that would wish that that practice was reinstated, that the judge would have to play the tune to show his ability to judge before he sat down to adjudicate, you know, his contemporaries. So that was interesting. So, these guys, were they coming over here to see what was going on? Or was it just Manson that had gone over there and somehow that got convoluted? Because he was certainly in Halifax around that time. And there was a broader exchange of musicians at that time as well. I mean, pipers and PEI would be coming over to perform at the North British Society in Halifax in the 1880s and the 1890s. And the Ganesh Highland Society, they would send a contingent over for the Highland Games, or the what they call the Scottish Gathering and PEI. And so there was a lot more interchange of ideas, and but they were all immigrant Gaels or second generation immigrant Gaels, or in some cases third generation immigrant Gaels. But you talked earlier about the effects of Scottish fiddling, dancing, etc., and you know, from the Shetland Islands. An interesting thing: I was at a conference in Alberta, and one of the guys, this was just after the Gathering of the Clans came out, actually it was in the mid-1990s, and people were wondering, what's the difference between Scottish Strathspeys and Cape Breton Strathspeys? And Sid Gerling, Piper, was there, used to play with the championship 78th Fraser Highlanders. We were sitting across the table from each other, and he was asking me, Barry, come on, what's the difference? And I said, well, you know, Sid, it's like instead of playing, but I'm thinking of the tune, Miss Drummond of Perth, right? We knew at home as Gilda Krupa Counts of Glown, so there were Gaelic words to it. And I sang the way that they used to play it, or that bands would play it, and then I sang the way that I had always heard it. Anyway, I was jigging this at the table, like hidum beaten di dum dee da dum ba dee da dum ba dum beaten di dum ba hidum bitten di. When one of the representatives from the Yukon, Ron, was there, and he said, oh my goodness, Barry, he said, I haven't heard anybody sing like that since my father passed away. And I said, really? Because, you know, he's got a lot of native blood in him, right? And I said, really? How would your father pick that up? And it turns out his father was a grandson of Colin Fraser, who was the Hudson Bay Piper. Yeah. And Ron said, oh, my father used to sing like that all the time, and my sister would dance. And I'm like, and you know, I'd been to conferences with Ron like probably three years before that, and never had any sort of inkling that, you know, I was sitting with one of Colin Fraser's descendants.
That's wild.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that type of jigging or singing was, you know, he recognized it right off. Whereas, you know, pipers that come from a competitive background find that kind of foreign, really.
Yeah.
That's how much the world had changed in the 20th century. So.
Huh. Yeah, that's cool. I don't know. I've the Gaelic songs or the Gaelic lyrics to these tunes, I've had The Night We Had the Goats stuck in my head ever since looking through Gathering, because I found it in Elizabeth Dixon's manuscript with the lyrics, and mm-hmm. like, I don't speak or read Gaelic particularly well, but seeing the English translation, like, well, that's been, like, The Night We Had the Goats, The Night We Had the Goats, like, yeah, that's it forever. That's in my head now. That's just going to live there.
Well, it's certainly not high poetry.
Right.
And, you know, it was denigrated for a long time, but I was talking to a woman in Benbecula a few years ago. I was over talking to her about Portia de Bale, and she said, you know, it's a good way to learn basics of the language for kids. Not only, you know, because a lot of kids, they gravitate towards, you know, musical little nursery rhymes, right? Sure. And so you don't know it, but you're learning basics of sentence construction and verb usage, right? And so, yeah, they're repetitive and they're kind of nonsensical. I'm working on with some friends of mine trying to translate another Portia de Bale, and it's talked about this. There, people are going to town and they see this baby, and the baby's got a flat head. And so everybody takes in the verse. They compare he's not much of a looker, I guess, this baby. And so they're saying, oh, he looks like Johnny Archie, or he looks like this other guy, and he's got a flat head. The poor guy when he grows up. And you know, it was a great way for satire. A lot of those tunes or the words, I really had local meaning, and you know, they would elicit a lot of spontaneous laughter at a party or whatever, when the person being, you know, poked
wasn't there.
Yeah. But it was just like I say, what I found when I was selecting tunes for the Gathering of the Clans, again, I go back to my interest in piping for step dancing, and you know, I had read Alistair McGilvery's research, I had looked into Helen Creighton's research, and I found that a lot of the fiddlers that they were trying to get, you know, a good number of them were pipers as well, like they were dual instrumentalists, and I thought, well, okay. And so I started learning the violin in 1981 from Carl McKenzie in Sydney at the Gaelic Society, and one of the first tunes he gave us to learn was Brenda Stubbard's Reel, who I thought, oh, that's a great reel, except I wasn't playing a C natural at the time, so I arranged that last bar to kind of bring it up a little bit, and I published that, and that's been since copied and republished and everything else, but that's where that tune came from.
It's such a good tune, man.
Yes, like, yeah.
It's just like, I don't know, in my head, I knew it had like some fiddle origins, but yeah, it was surprising coming across it, like, oh, hey, this is where that tune comes from.
Yeah. Because
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. And it must have been everywhere, like, within less than a decade. Because I was hearing it, because I know, like, it's on Ashley MacIsaac's album with a piper playing it, Gravel Walk into Brenda Stibbert's, which is, like, just such a good set progression. Or, you know, that's always been, when I was a kid, that was it. But I had heard that before MacIsaac put it out on Helter Skeltic, like, it was already around, so it must have been, like you said, just immediately. Like, came out and Gathered in the Clans and almost...
And, you know, next day. You can use that as a classic example of how quickly a good tune will spread. My brother was working in Spain, and he was walking by a pub in Galicia, and he heard Piper's there playing Brenda Stubbard's Reel. although Jerry had a great ear for a good tune. He was quite a tunesmith. When you get deeper into the music... Brenda Stubbert's a great tune, but there's a little hint of John Morrison of Ascent House, and there's a little hint of Cicely Ross, who was Willie Ross's daughter. But still, it's a standalone tune, of course. And so now I do a slide on the instead of the C natural. So when I started looking at that one, I thought, gee, I wonder how many more fiddle tunes might be actually pipe tunes. Because when you talk about fiddling and how... I think piping had a big effect on Cape Breton fiddling, and that when you talk to fiddlers, they sometimes put a wild note in, like a high B, really just kind of brightens it up. So I started looking at tunes. Kate Dunley had put a book, Traditional Fiddle Music. It was a little tiny book, and I started going through there, and I thought, okay, well, if I just play a high A instead of a high B, that's a pipe tune. And then I started cross-referencing those with the David Glenn collection. I bought a big hardcover, all 17 books. And, Kate Dunley and her partner at the time, they just said traditional reel, traditional Strathspey, traditional reel. Anyway, I was finding them in the Glenn collection and in the Gunn collection. And, you know, fiddlers are not really that good at tune titles. I mean, sure. You mentioned Ashley. He recorded that great Bobby McLeod jig called, or it was a march, John McKenzie of Loch Torridon, or sometimes Murdo McKenzie of Loch Torridon. But he didn't have a name, so he called it Creme de Menthe. So names get dropped, and all of a sudden the traditional label is put on it. So I wrote to Kate, and when she did an update of it, she had cross-referenced some of the ones which were popular. And again, I think that comes from the dual musicianship of fiddlers and also being pipers. So
I immediately assume that fiddlers put in a high B just to differentiate themselves, right? Like, oh, well, yeah, this is a pipe tune, but pipers can't do this.
well, actually, a friend of mine who's from Pictou County, he told me he saw a pipe chanter years ago in Pictou County that had the thumb...
Had the thumbnail
print. Yeah, so they were in the back eight. They were playing high Bs on some tunes then.
Is that like a singular thing, or have you come across a couple chanters like
no,
that?
No, and
I cut you off. I cut you off when you were in the middle of telling that. So just tell the listeners like what's going on here. What's this crease in the back eight?
Right, and so I've never actually seen the chanter, but okay. I was told by a friend of mine who lives actually in BC now. He remembers as a kid seeing a chanter. So if you set up your chanter reed soft enough and you cover half of the high A hole and increase pressure, you can actually extend the nine notes up to 10 by including a high B. They were calling them pinch notes, and I think you had done some great work and
I'm struggling. I can do it. I've actually, pretty successfully recorded a tune that uses a high C as well, kind of doing the same thing. It's sort of funny that Channer reed is sort of kaput. Like, and it definitely, I think it shortens the life of the Channer reed significantly. Mm-hmm. I remember hanging out with Tim Britton, who's a Illan pipe maker and a Highland piper as well. Here in Iowa. It's so funny. He was doing a performance, I think during COVID. So it was like just him alone in a stadium or whatever, but he was mostly like playing flute and Illan pipes. And then he just like busted out Highland pipes and played a Pibroch. Like, and we're just going to finish with this. Like, all right, way to go, Tim. But when he was working on my Illan pipe reed, he took it all the way up to the third octave rather than just the full two octaves. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know the Illan pipe channer could go up there. And he was saying, yeah, that's just, it breaks the reed in a lot faster.
Yeah.
And it really does. I've been playing more like band concert pitch Channer because I don't have a good B flat set up right now.
Yeah.
And I did the same thing. I was like pinching all the way up to like high E, which is just, it just sounds like a tuning or like a dog whistle at that stage, yeah. But it's definitely breaking the reed in faster.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think John Daly, didn't he say he has an old Channer too that might have that that thumb line?
He may, I'm not sure. The other guy, you had mentioned Mackenzie Bailey and the Irish pipes. He actually had a Laurie Chanter, and he put a high B key on it, pipe chanter, to extend the range. But you know, he made all his own reeds, and he used to put copper staples on his pipe chanter reeds to make them softer. But his pipes are still in existence. See, he was in the Marine Artillery, and they fought on land, but they traveled with the Navy. And so, you know, he had seen action in... he was at the relief of Khartoum, the bombardment of Alexandria. He was on the West Coast, in the Niger River Delta. So musicians were sought after in the Navy. And where he learned, he was already a violinist before he left Nova Scotia and joined the Marine Artillery. But I suspect he learned to play the Irish pipes when he was on those long voyages to the Antipodes and to West Africa, etc. And the set was made by Leo Rosen's uncle. Okay. And so I have some pictures of that. The Chanter has a bit of a stop on it. I showed it to one of the pipe makers down in the Piper's Gathering a few years ago, and he said he had never seen that particular device. He said it wasn't common to use that. I don't know what it was. It's almost like a little cup that slides on the end. I can send you a picture of it.
I mean, there's a lot of Illan pipe sets have those little like single hinge coverings for the bottom, so you know, it can conceal the bottom of the chanter. In theory, easier, but I think it just makes it harder because you've got one more thing to fail rather than just putting it on your leg.
Right.
But yeah, if it's a sliding thing, I always wonder.
I better not look at the picture again. But it's just that he had looked at that and he said, oh, that's unusual how they've set that up. So
I wonder, you know, one of the things that, you know, sets Illan pipes apart from some of the other, there's lots of things that set it apart, but you're missing that leading note, right? Like the low G equivalent on a Highland pipe channel we don't have, but on pastoral pipes they did when there was that foot, right? So really old Irish pipes, when we still call them pastoral, have that foot so you can get the leading note. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a lot of them were removable, right? Where you could just kind of pop it on and off.
Yeah.
You think he learned how to play Illan pipes on a ship? What a nightmare that would be, though, for tuning.
He was pretty musical. He was always on the ship. I mean, he also found time to learn to play the pipes. He was taught by the by his wife and his father-in-law. His father-in-law was Sandy McLennan, who was a gold medalist. And so he actually, Bailey actually got himself a recruiting sergeant in Inverness so he could pursue Pibroch more. He was a tremendous musician. I have a flyer. He was playing in PEI in 1913. He would sing Gaelic songs, Scots songs, and he entertained on the violin, the Highland pipes, the border pipes, and the Irish pipes. And
it actually says border pipes on the...
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Does it say border pipe, or it might say real pipes? I'd have to check it. But if you go to the website, Cape Breton piper.com and go to the history section and just look up Mackenzie Bailey. It talks about his career, and there's a photo of that flyer that was sent out. It's like an advertisement brochure, right. And it shows some of the medals he won for violin playing in Scotland. Wow. So he was quite a musician. Yeah.
So Catherine McLennan,
yes.
His wife, who you think taught him. Do we know any more information about her? You kind of had a list of the people that she probably taught in Canada, but
yeah. Not a whole lot. I know that she was kind of a crusty woman, I guess, because you know I'm descended from home children, and I did come across during my research a woman who was sent to the Bailey home as a British home child, and she's the one that had to get the fire going in the morning. Said Catherine was not that nice to her, although Mackenzie Bailey actually took her once to visit his brother in Earltown, which would have been 12 miles away. That was the first time she was ever off the farm. Because he was away quite a bit in vaudeville, and I had a schedule on that website as well. And he was going around teaching piping and performing in PEI. And his son, Alexander or Sandy, he ended up marrying a girl from PEI, had two children, and she died young. But they would play at dances with piano and pipes and piano and violin. And she actually played a set of those. Whether they're real pipes or border pipes, I have no idea. They're currently in Western Canada, and I'm trying to get a suitable photograph of them because they're bellow blown, right? So,
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about pinching notes, the thing I noticed about Alec for his particular style of playing, he could get more sounds out of a chanter than I've ever heard anybody before. And I think that was part of the unique fingering style that he had. I think probably what happened when the bands started coming on in the mid-19th century, they kind of dumbed piping down a bit. It had, you know, because you're going to have a band, you have to have unison playing. And so you had this wonderful, varied tradition, and then you had pipe band movement and published collections kind of becoming a funnel. So by the time you hit the 20th century, you have this perfectly formed, standardized method of playing. And that's poured out too by both the printed collections that came out and a lot of the field recordings that I've either done or people have sent me. It was just a wide variety of playing techniques and tune settings, some of which I put in that last book. I did a workshop for the Western United States Pipe Band Association last month, and Strathspey's, I kind of went through the whole thing. I did find examples of the Strathspey minuet, of course, which had Gaelic words, which was a couples dance, and then the Strathspey reel, and then they had Strathspeys that would just be show tunes, like Lady Madalena Sinclair. It's not a step dance tune, right? It's more a slow pastoral Strathspey. So why all of a sudden we just have there's a Strathspey and there's a reel and there's no variations in that. Whereas in the 19th century and part of the 18th century, it was a lot broader. So I'm not denigrating modern piping. I'm just saying, let's look at, what came before and we could be having a lot more fun.
Right. There's a diversity of experiences before. So I got really excited kind of looking through the collection and reading the introduction, kind of feeling like somehow Cape Breton pipers missed out on that, but they didn't. Basically, they went through the same kind of, in my head there's a kind of straight line from military piping to competition piping to everything's kind of get that, like you said, that narrow vision of what piping should be, and Nova Scotians went through the same.
Yeah, but same thing. For us it came at a much later date. And so like I talk about the heyday of the dance piper in Cape Breton and northeastern Nova Scotia, and it ended earlier in PEI, but it held on again longer in the west coast of Newfoundland. I interviewed MacArthur pipers who played for step dancers and square sets. And so you had these, there was that parallel piping culture in the 20th century. See, even though there's very little economic advantage to living in Cape Breton, once they closed the coal mines down and shut the steel plant down, but that's what attracted I mean, I'm going to backtrack a bit on that. So when we look at piping in Cape Breton and northeastern Nova Scotia, because they were all intertwined, you had that first big wave of Highland immigrants coming over with their essentially a soloist tradition of dance music, community piping, you know, for births, christenings, laments at funerals, and of course the pinnacle of a piper would be playing for social dancing. That's what they did, right? It didn't cost anything. You didn't need to have a kilt. You didn't have to have fancy shoes. People would dance with their bare feet sometimes. So it was a low-cost method of entertainment. And there were over 80 immigrant pipers just to Nova Scotia and Cape Breton in that immigrant period. And that was passed on. Nobody bothered with us, right, until industrialization. Coal mining was small scale, but towards the end of the 19th century, it was much larger, and a lot of people were either, you're left with two choices. If you didn't inherit the farm, you could go work in the coal mines or go to the Boston States, which was anywhere south of Maine, because they ended up in California and west in Utah. So they were all over the place. What happened with the industrialization, though, it's coal mining, steel plant, light manufacturing, the development of the railway, was a second wave of immigrant pipers coming in, much smaller than the first. And they differed in the fact that they were largely English-speaking or lowland Scots. They had military or pipe band experience. And that's where we see the nucleus of these pipe bands develop in the urban centers, like Halifax and Pictou and in Cape Breton. And so you have a parallel piping culture that existed for much of the first half of the 20th century. Of course, we know which side won, because like I say, when I was, you know, trying to find friends of mine and even people that were like 10 years older than me, you know, did you ever step to pipe dance, to pipe music? No, I never heard tell of that before. But I talked to old people and they described these scenes of people, you know, the burnt piper, John McKinnon in Inverness in the 1920s, playing for square sets and then tuning his pipes up and then playing for solo step dancers and then tuning his pipes up all afternoon, right? And so, you know, and then I was looking at the music and I was thinking, what's wrong? But why have we lost that ability? And so when I was putting the first book together, The Gathering of the Clans, I said, okay, if I'm going to get people to play this, I need a couple of things. I have to establish a historical link, which is why I wanted to put those photos in and talk about the famous pipers that come over and mention step dancing. And then I went to the Glen Collection and picked a couple of tunes out of there because you couldn't get them online like today, late 1980s. And I started acquiring old collections of books. And then I went to the fiddle repertory. And I'm not the first to do that. I mean, David Glenn, if you go through his collections, you look at the number of fiddle tunes that have been compressed to fit on a 9-note scale.
Right.
A friend of mine, Charlie Brown, he was in the band with me. You know, he played fiddle, tin whistle, pipes, and concertina. He gave me two tunes, Heather Hill by Danner McDonald, arranged for the pipes, and John McNeil, or Big John McNeil. So they're included in there. Because when I play those at Cayley's, people immediately recognize them because they've heard them on the violin for the last 50 years.
Sure.
And then I went to Kate Dunley's book, and I said, okay, ooh, that's a pipe tune. I'm just going to get rid of that high B, or make a couple of other subtle changes, put grace notes in, and right away I got a dandy dance tune, and people would be familiar with it. Tunes like Coat d'Amour Alisage, or, you know, Elizabeth's Big Coat. You know, and I'm going around talking to some of these older people, and tunes sometimes were associated with different areas. I played that tune for two Matheson brothers in River Dennis. And I said, did they play this around here? And they said, oh, no, that's a Mabu tune. So, you know, we never played that one here. We had our own tunes. That was kind of from over there. And then in the meantime, you know, as years progressed, I found another setting, well, a totally different setting with a similar title over in the North Shore. So it's been, you know, it was great to have that first book out because people started learning tunes from it. And I was looking the other day, the fourth edition went to press in 2007. And so now I'm just shy of the 4,000 mark. I haven't figured out exactly, because now I just get, you know, 25 copies here, 50 copies there, 10 copies. I still sell a few copies here and there. The big promotion for that, of course, was people like Scott's Highland Supplies. You know, they bought, I think, 900 copies over the first 10 years, right? So, or close to it. No money in that. Like I mentioned in email, it's a, you know, you make a dollar a book by the time everything is done. So I'm quite happy with it. The unintended consequence, and I didn't think this was going to happen, as people started buying the book, then they said, well, would you come out and show us how the tunes are played? And that's where I first started getting out to Seattle. I've been teaching there on and off since the late 1990s. Done workshops in Des Moines, Iowa, and Utah, and Florida, and Vermont, and Oregon. So, I mean, it's yeah, I met some wonderful people, and it all really started off with that little white book.
Yeah, so, it's a great book. Like, well, I guess that's a good kind of follow up. Like, you've been, this isn't your only book, obviously. This is the first one. We've been talking a lot about Play It Like You Sing It, I think, kind of. How has your approach to like publishing books about this changed? Has it changed? And you have a new collection coming out pretty soon too.
Yeah, right? Hopefully February of next year, which is what I tried to do with the last book, the last double volume, Play It Like You Sing It, was to concentrate on 19th century music in regional settings, right? Because, like I say, when the first book came out in 1991, people would get it and say, oh, are you interested in that? Because I have this old tape of, you know, my granduncle playing in 1956 or something, right? And I'm thinking, yeah, I'd love to get a copy of that. Or, you know, the late Duncan McIntyre said, well, I've got, you know, reel-to-reels of Joe Huey playing my father. And I said, oh, I'd love to get those. And so I get copies of those. And then you're hearing these tunes that you never heard before. And so I'm trying to rebuild a repertory, which is largely regionally based, of different settings of tunes, and some that, you know, either were composed here or had been forgotten in Scotland. And that is still building. I've always collected tunes. And so this next book coming up in 2022 will take us from the 19th century into the 20th and early 21st century. So I've got a lot of tunes from friends of mine, some that I didn't know they died before I was born. So it takes you from the post-World War I period, you know, that people were composing tunes, and then right up through the 40s and 50s, right up until just actually a few weeks ago. Yeah. And then I have a small section on PEI music, because I've moved my attention over to there. It's harder to do because I'm 3,000 miles away, but there's a few surprises there, like Angus Mackay's grandnephew played there until the 1930s.
Really?
Of course, the Rankins, Con Dooley was there, and I have a bit about him. And his son Neil set up the first Pibroch competition there in 1863, and was trying to get a Pibroch society started to preserve the music. So in a certain extent, they were trying to pursue the aims of the Highland Society of London. And somewhere, someplace, there's got to be an old trunk with all this stuff in it.
Right.
I suspect the fabled third volume of the Campbell Counterrock is probably either in PEI or Nova Scotia somewhere, if it hasn't been thrown out. And I've got an idea where it might be. I'm not going to tell that to anybody. I've approached the person several times, but she's adamant, you know, there's nothing like that there. And so, yeah, she's rather suspicious of any sort of researches coming by. Anyway, you never know. It might turn up later. But it's been a fun ride. And like I say, when I look back and I see the number of people now that are, you know, a lot of people are trying to play step dance music, and they don't have the benefit of my learning, because they didn't learn from an old piper or go around. And it's not like they couldn't. I have some friends, and they told me, they said, why should I do that when you're going to do it and put the tunes out? And I said, yeah, well, you know, that's the story of my life. Why does anybody they know I'm going to do it anyway because I'm interested in it. And so why bother do it themselves, I guess. But pipers are lazy and cheap.
You said it. You said it. I didn't. What the one of the people that I reached out and asked for questions had something that you kind of touched on there a couple times of, like, what is the key? Is there a way to actually? Can I just? Is there a trick to reading the music and getting it right, or is it? It really is. You kind of have to look at the music, but also hear it to try to capture that sound correctly. Or
certainly, that's the best way is to have. Yeah. You know, these are still your best teachers. And you know, I remember doing piping workshops from the competitive style for the Pipe Band Association home, and you'd get kids that had been playing for 3 or 4 years. You'd give them a new tune, and inevitably they'd say, "Sir, can you play it so I can hear how it goes?" And we really haven't changed that much.
Right.
We don't get a lot of musical theory. So it's what I try to tell people now when I do workshops is it all comes down to templates. And that'll give you a basic structure. But, you know, there's a lot of nuances as far as technique that require a certain amount of listening and practice to get it. And it depends on which style. I mean, I looked at the questions and somebody was wondering about piping from the Judic area in Cape Breton. I don't have any Judic-specific examples, unless they come down through the violin tradition. The violin tradition continued, whereas a lot of the old pipers like McDougall and McMaster and those guys died. And even, I think there's a family there still known as the Pipers, but nobody in four generations has played the pipes, but still they have that that nickname to them. So yeah, what you see and play it like you sing it is all I could get from people giving me tapes and some of my own field work. It was so refreshing to go see Leonard MacArthur on the west coast of Newfoundland, and I wanted to record them, and they didn't want to play in front of me. They were too shy, and they said, "Well, you play first." And so I played my pipes, and Leonard said, "Oh, can I try your pipes? Because they're going better than mine." And we went out on the step, and he started to tune his pipes to E, right?
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Which is mentioned in Logan's book, but it's been poo-pooed ever since, saying it's impossible to tune pipes to E. Anyway, I said to Leonard, I said, "That sounds good, Leonard. Can I ask you a question? Why are you tuning the pipes to E?" And he looked at me, he goes, "What's an E?" I mean, Leonard plays violin, pipes, and I think he might play guitar a bit, all by ear, right? And so, but they had, you know, there's some tunes I got from them and from their brother Jimmy and from Sears. And again, you know, that's a recent tradition. I'm talking to people that either went to dances and danced to pipe music or actually played for dances themselves. So I try to explain when I talk about templates, music is written in bar lines, but the bar lines don't reflect the phrase, right? Yeah. You'll find that the phrase ends just before the end of the bar, and then whatever note or 2/8 notes that are there, really you steal a lot of the time and put it on the end, and then you use that almost as you're taking a breath to get into the next phrase. Right? Yeah. So that's what's very confusing. We don't get enough musical theory. We just get enough to make us dangerous.
Sure.
Because we play when I was learning the violin, I went to see Elmer Briand, whose mother was a Gaelic speaker. He was an Acadian, and his father played the pipes a bit, but he played the violin. Wonderful man, a wonderful composer, and a nice fiddler. I went over with my violin, and I said, "Elmer, I'm looking for some lessons." He goes, "Oh, yeah, yeah." He said, "Do you play?" I said, "I'll play a couple of tunes." And so I played, straight up, cutting bracken as a strass bay, right? You know, da-dum. And he looked at me and said, "You're a piper, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, how'd you?" "Yeah," I said, "I am. But how'd you know that?" He said, "Because you're playing that tune," he said, "in a straight line." And he said, "Music isn't like that." And I thought, well, there you go. And so you go back to these tunes, and it all comes down to you're going to play off the music. But when I talk about templates, you realize it's not just playing straight, right? You have these little nuanced phrases. Sometimes it's a one bar, sometimes it's a two bar. If you hear somebody playing it or somebody singing it, then you say, "Oh, well, you know, it just makes perfect sense." But if you've got you know, two lines of music in a reel and you're playing it as written. That's what Joe Neal says. You're missing out on the taste or the flavor of the way it goes.
Yeah.
So I've had to, you know, and I talk about, you do this for quick steps, like, or, you know, marches, jigs, especially. I've heard tapes of Danny Roryak and McDougal down north playing jigs, where he doesn't start the first note with a G grace note. And if you go to, like, Glens and Guns, you'll find their jigs, the first note is plain, and the G grace note and the D grace note comes on the next two notes. So instead of playing, he plays. Right? Just little things you can do. I mean, you can't do it in competition because it's prescribed. But, you know, if you want to have us, like, one of the people that wrote the question said they have a little couple of sets of Cape Breton stuff. Wonderful.
Right.
Keep it separate. And then, you know, competition. Again, competition music is really templates as well. There's really, if you want to win a prize, there's one way to play a march, and there's one way to play a Strathspey, and there's one way to play a reel and a jig. But, you know, if you're playing solo and for yourself or on small pipes or something, then, you know, you're at liberty to, you know, to massage the tempo, you know, work around the phrasing, what appeals to you. Throw some vibrato in or...
Hey, so yeah, like I said, we're just going to relocate a couple bits of conversation here. So I'm just coming back in because there's sort of no clean way to do it. And this is as good a spot to any just to kind of follow up on some things. You know, we do have this bit of a discussion about Major Bailey's Illand Pipe Chanter and that kind of interesting foot. Barry sent me some pictures of it. The set of pipes were made by some relative of Leo Rowson's. I think it's his uncle. And yeah, that foot joint is super gnarly. It's rather than, you know, a single hinge foot joint, or not foot joint, but stop joint, stop valve, stop flap, whatever you call those things. Rather than a single hinge, it is. It's just, it seems like it's a little metal cage that would kind of slide up and down. You can't see it close enough to see if there's a spring or something in there in the photo he sent. But I'll put that in the show notes as well. I also was looking at the advertisement that Barry was talking about of Major Bailey. And yeah, it's indeed, he's going to perform on lowland pipes is what it says. Which, you know, after talking with James McDonald Reed a bit, it seems like lowland pipes was sort of the norm for, you know, what to call the bellows-blown pipes that is kind of sometimes known as reel pipes or border pipes or lowland pipes. But lowland pipes seem to be pretty darn popular in the 60s still, 1960s, and clearly when Bailey was playing them too. So anyway, so we're going to go back to Barry, kind of finish out the conversation here, and kind of transitioning to... Barry's talking about his new collection of tunes, that book that's going to talk about Prince Edward Island Pipers and kind of other locations, I think is sort of what we were talking about when this thread picks up again.
So were there other areas that probably had unique style of playing? I'm sure there were. But as time goes by, people stop playing. And because a lot of them couldn't read or write music, a lot of that tradition has died. So yeah. I'm really quite happy and fortunate that I managed to grab the last of it. Because, well, Alec died in 1998. He would have been the last person to learn by ear beginning. But, you know, I don't play like he does. A couple of things I'll show at a workshop just to show some of the alternate fingering techniques. Like he played a tune, it's in the book called... The Forest Going Afire, and it's all bottom hand work. And when I videotaped him, he keeps the C finger down, right? Which is false fingering.
According to the rules, yeah.
According to the Piper's Bible. And I said, Alec, you keep that C finger down. Why do you do that? He goes, well, there's no C in that tune. And I'm thinking, yeah, so why would you lift the C finger? Now, I've talked to Uilleann Pipers, you could probably confirm this, and they tell me, some of them have told me that, you know, if you're not using that note, you just leave the finger on the chanter, kind of as a anchor. And so that's what he was doing. But some of the tunes he played, you know, I've tried to get them as close as I could. They're not quite C natural, but they're not quite C sharp. That's why I'm thinking that it wasn't just nine notes for a lot of these pipers years ago. Sure. They were imitating the human voice, and the human voice is not restricted to nine notes.
I keep on the really early, I guess the third or second season of the podcast, which is, you know, locked away in an embarrassing vault now. But I was comparing, like, Donald McDonald's tunes. Looking at Neil Dickey's stuff and this idea of, like, kitchen piping, like, we're doing this new thing with bagpiping, it just always struck me as, like, well, that's absurd, because, like, this is what Donald McDonald's tunes are, too. Like, yeah. And, you know, I love Gordon Duncan's stuff. But yeah, it's that same thing where he's sort of praised for adding more notes to the chanter. Like, well, it's really, like you said, there's really that funnel effect where there were so many diverse approaches to playing and performance and different music styles that just got condensed to nine notes. And
yeah,
it's just, I don't know. It's weird to think of, it's weird to think how things, rather than becoming more, it's not weird. It's not weird at all that things become more the same as the world gets sort of smaller or you know, as the world kind of progresses through time. But it's disappointing,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think as far as traditional music, it's kind of circular in nature, too. You know, the folk music revivals of the 60s, I know in Nova Scotia there was another one. They usually last about 10 years in the 70s. I talked to a guy who was an immigrant from Ireland. They had a little group, and they made quite a living. Good living, playing, you know, pub songs. Then, of course, in the 90s, you almost had the Awakening Gale, where you had the Rankin family, the Barry McNeils and Laura Smith, and they were singing really, you know, folk music with a 1990s twist. But again, that petered out after a while, and so we're about due for another renaissance. Sure. My brother and I used to, because I learned first, and then I taught three of my brothers how to play. And so my youngest brother, George, we would have a few beer and I'd be at a party and play pipes with their hands on, you know, on the other's chant.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I think, you know, people say, wow, look at that, look at that. And then I was reading a bit about the McKinnons from East Lake Ainslie, who came from the Isle of Muck in 1820. And my brother and sister, Big Farker, and his sister Annie would play pipes with each other's hand on the chanter. So really, there's nothing new.
Yeah, right.
Just people forget it, and then they say, wow. The same thing with pibroch embellishments. Like when John McKenzie's Fancy came out, people were just blown away the worldwide. And that was in, McFadgen's book came out in the 70s, and that was breaking all the boundaries. Using a dree in a hornpipe, ooh, unheard of. Which was why, and you know, I was caught up in that bug too, right? But then when you hear these old guys do it, I don't know. There was just a wonderful lift to their playing, which I don't think you can annotate in staff notation. I know the old McIntyre pipers were adamant in Clay's Bay that their kids not learn to read music because they were afraid it would change the way they would play. And if you listen to that tape by Joe Neil McNeil, you'll find a lot of the older Gales kind of felt that way too. And so, yeah, we had more pipers and they were playing standardized technique, but, you know, they lost a bit. They lost a lot.
I always have this love-hate relationship with competitions, you know, where I wonder, you know, I look at, you know, lowland piping or border pipes, and how that essentially is a dead tradition, and you know that's been revived pretty successfully, I think. Mm-hmm. But I wonder in Scotland anyway if Highland pipes would have gone that same way if it weren't for the competitions. So like, there's a like, oh, it's good that like those competitions clearly did some good of like keeping pibroch around, keeping some of that music around, but also fundamentally changing it.
Yeah. The old double-edged sword analogy, right? Competition and, you know, the pipe ban, and, you know, I've heard people slag military piping and pipe bands, but, you know, it's a big, wide, wonderful world out there, and we should be looking to expand and be more inclusive. And I'd still say that, you know, the pipe band or the Kilted Piper is still one of the biggest attractions for younger people to get interested in the music. I mean, that's what kind of, that's the bait, right? That's what draws them in. And it's a wonderful historical based instrument. I mean, you look at tune titles, you know, the 79th Farewell to Gibraltar. Well, what were they doing in Gibraltar? You know, the Earl of Mansfield, who in the heck was he? Then you get into Pibroch, you've got another historical angle. So, it, you know, people that are interested in history really like bagpipe music. Because it's not just melody, it's, you know, what caused the melody to be composed in the first place and named for a person, event, or...
There's that bardic kind of level to it. Right?
Well, and, you know, if you go back far enough, like Ian Dahl Mackay... composed The Unjust Incarceration and The Blind Piper's Obstinacy. He was a bard as well. And there is some referencing to Patrick McCrimmon having some poems attributed to him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these guys were the entertainers of society, right? And that's why when the harp started to give way to the pipes, and I was reading Keith Singh today, you know, the violin was coming in then too. That's why you had so many dual musicians, because, you know, if I'm making my living playing the harp and all of a sudden some guy's cranking out a few tunes on a reeded instrument, well, guess what? Yeah. If I want to have a job tomorrow, I better learn how to play that, or somebody, my son who's going to follow my profession, better get on that too, right? And so you have that transition period where you've got one instrument, then you've got that transition period of both instruments, and then gradually, as in Cape Breton, piping became less favorable and the violin took off. The number of piping families, like Ashley's granduncle was a piper, right? Kinnan Beaton, Andrew Beaton, their grandfather, I think, was a piper and a fiddler. And so, yeah, Mike McDougall's father and grandfather were pipers and fiddlers, but he concentrated on the violin. He didn't play the pipes. So you see, again, that transition period of dual musicianship, and then all of a sudden they're just concentrating on one. But really, for any instrument in society, it's more utility. It's what you're doing in that society. And as long as society was, you know, fairly homogeneous and isolated, then that's what people listen to. And then, of course, with radio and television, and they replace the extended family as sort of any sort of cultural influencers, then they became to get a North American perspective. And the, you know, even fiddle music, I remember as a kid growing up in industrialized centers, that was hick music. You know, and square dancing, that's old people stuff, sure. Right? But, you know, having said that... my class, you know, I'd go to parties and somebody would inevitably ask me to play a few tunes on the pipes, and, you know, most of them would go outside for a smoke.
I remember we had the pipe major, some folks from a pipe band in Minneapolis come up to, like, I was in this kind of funny little parade band when I was in college of just all, you know, grade five or whatever pipers. But they brought this, you know, some decent pipers up from McAllister Pipe Band to, like, do a lesson. We went up to the bar afterwards and they got up to play and, like, they just didn't get a good response from the bar. And these guys immediately were like, no, this isn't a good town for bagpiping. And, like, I knew, like, I had played for those people. Like, you just gotta wait about three more drinks and then they'll love it. It'll be like Neil Diamond has come on. You just gotta wait.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, when the small pipes broke on the market, my late wife said, you know, she felt that most Highland pipers were frustrated session musicians. And the reason shuttle pipes and small pipes took off is because at last we could sit in and not get people to leave a room. and, you know, with the different keyed chanters, you could play comfortably with other instruments and in a more drawing room or front room setting. And, you know, that her words have been, you know, proven out, because look at the number of people that are playing small pipes now, and they're not just playing standard embellishments. Some of them are trying vibrato or, you know, half notes. And I play a Gaelic air And so on my Ray Sloan small pipes, I have to close the devil holes over with both knees to get that. It approximates a low F sharp. And so somebody says, how do you get an F sharp? Did you use keys? I said, no, I use knees. I think Stuart Little has done something like that on the Highland pipe. But you know what? I remember seeing Charlie Brown, I think, in Nova Scotia doing something like that too back in the 70s. It just goes around and people forget things, and then, you know, people try different things. But piping, I think nowadays with the internet, I wish I had, the opportunities in the 70s that kids have now, because you could, any type of music you want, you can learn it on the net. Although, an old friend of mine, he was lamenting the fact he heard some of the pipers in the early 2000s, because they used to have a small band in Sydney, and I taught there for a while. But people really, they were doing it because their parents wanted them to do it. But really, you're wasting time with some people. If they don't have that bug, they're not going to really practice. And Patty McIntyre said, I can't understand it, Barry. He said, kids now have more opportunity, more time to practice. But they're getting worse, he said, instead of better. So I thought about that, and I thought, for Cape Breton, there's probably always going to be a piper in Cape Breton, but there won't always be a Cape Breton piper.
I do think that is a more pessimistic tone than Barry generally takes, so I feel slightly bad ending on it, but what is clearly true to me is that any Cape Breton pipers presently or in the future will be very lucky to have the benefit of Barry's work to guide them for what it has been in the past and kind of can be in the future. So be sure to check out these books. They're outstanding. Play It Like You Sing It's a little bit harder to find now, because it's kind of sold out, basically, in a lot of places. But I was still able to snag up a copy in some bagpipe supply companies in the States. So if you don't have a copy yet, look for it and get it. It's a 2-volume set. Volume 2 has all the music in it. Volume 1 has a lot of research and stuff. So check that out. Gathering the Clans is still available. Check out CapeBretonPiper.com, Barry's website. There is vintage bagpipe parts for sale, some of his music, books. He's also got a kind of lovely digital museum and archives to see there, full of photographs of original instruments and recordings of Cape Breton pipers. If you like the show, you can support it on patreon.com/waytootwog. We're going out now on Barry Shears playing some tunes that he wrote on small pipes with David McIsaac, accompanying him on guitar. He recorded these in his apartment in Halifax in 1998. We should be back in a couple of weeks to finish off the last episode of season 5. Cheers.